It is Monday, February the 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Iraqi forces going after the Islamic State's control of western Mosul.
The loss of their heaviest concentration of control in terms of population, this is their most significant victory, and as a result, it will be its most significant defeat.
Also ahead, latest on what President Trump is doing and saying. We'll have more on a new biopic, a biopic from the British, and what's buzzing on social media. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces have launched a large-scale military operation to dislodge Islamic State militants from the western half of the city of Mosul. It is a battle that is expected to be prolonged and difficult, but could be a psychological victory for Iraq, as University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis tells VOA's Victor Beatty.
Certainly, ridding Mosul of ISIS will be an important victory, both strategically and psychologically, given the importance that that city has had for ISIS, for their so-called caliphate. This is an ancient city that goes back to biblical times, and it's been an important center, not just for Muslims, but for Christians and other minorities as well. And so it seems a particularly ironic place where such an extremist, intolerant group would have been able to hold on for so long. So I'm sure the vast majority of people who live there or once lived there will be very happy for their liberation. But indeed, those back alleys, I mean, think of the Battle of Algiers and other of these ugly counterinsurgency struggles in the narrow warrens of these ancient cities, and one can see what a nightmare it would be strategically to try to dislodge the ISIS forces.
Do you think this will be a tougher fight than it was for eastern Mosul?
Very much so. I mean, again, both the nature of the old city, but also you need, you require crossing a river and dealing with a higher population density and the risk of civilian casualties.
This, of course, is where the Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared a self-styled caliphate over parts of Syria and Iraq in 2014. Do we know his whereabouts?
No, we don't. Not exactly. The leadership of ISIS is primarily Iraqi, both the military and political. They were people who were radicalized during the U.S. occupation and counterinsurgency war. Many of them were held prisoners in U.S. Prisons, some of whom were not initially radical, became radical given some of the maltreatment that took place there. But they do not see this. So even though they may be Iraqi themselves, they do not honor or observe the rather arbitrary artificial boundaries that colonial powers imposed on the region at the time of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire nearly 100 years ago. And so, they are also in Syria and pretty much anywhere that ISIS can spread its influence.
Stephen, what will the capture of Western Mosul mean for Islamic State?
Mosul is a second largest city in Iraq. It's It will be the loss of their heaviest concentration of control in terms of population. Obviously, with the strategic location in terms of the river, major highways, and almost any way you look at it, it was their most significant victory, and as a result, it will be its most significant defeat. There are two problems, though. One, of course, as we've seen, they are also willing to rely not just on controlling areas and governing them, but also in having these decentralized networks of terrorist cells, which are willing to strike just about anywhere, including in the West. The other problem is what helped lead to the rise of ISIS in the first place. What might be even more difficult than a military victory for the Iraqi government is being able to have a political solution that would satisfy the needs of the people. ISIS was able to walk in effectively to Mosul because the Baghdad government, dominated by sectarian Shia parties, did not treat the population of this largely Sunni city well. When there were nonviolent protests and general strikes and other forms of civil resistance, the Baghdad government responded with brutal repression. There was an enormous amount of corruption. The leadership was not respected. And so when ISIS came in and promised to liberate the people from this kind of rule, most people in Mosul essentially let them walk in. And the troops and police that were supposed to guard the city either laid down their arms or fled. And so the task before the Baghdad government is to make sure that the leadership that will take back control of Mosul is one that has support of the population, or at least has respect of the population to the point that they won't look for some kind of savior in the form of these Islamist extremists.
That's Stephen Zunis, a professor at the University of San Francisco and an international relations scholar specializing in the Middle East. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Also in the news, Israel's Haaretz newspaper is reporting that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met secretly a year ago with the leaders of Egypt and Jordan in a failed attempt by the Obama administration to convene a wider regional summit on Israeli-Palestinian peace. VOA asked Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College if he's surprised by this news.
Well, yes and no. It's surprising in that the news hasn't leaked prior to now. In his last years, President Obama did commission then-Secretary of State John Kerry to do about as much as he could to push for a final breakthrough. So that in and of itself isn't surprising. I think what is surprising is that it stayed secret this long. What it did reveal, however, was I think really two things, and that is number one, the U.S. continues to rely on its allies in the Arab world, notably Egypt and Jordan, to really do a lot of the heavy lifting. Number two, it's interesting to note that the U.S. pointedly did not include the Palestinian leadership. And number three, it has shown something that I've mentioned to you before, which is the extent to which Prime Minister Netanyahu's own domestic political problems continue to get in the way of the peace process. He felt then, apparently, according to Haaretz, that his more right-wing partners in his coalition would not go for the deal. So I think now it just shows a number of things, both about the thinking of the Obama administration at that time, as well as the constraints, domestic constraints, on the Israeli prime minister.
Apparently, it was referenced last week in a joint news conference when Prime Minister Netanyahu was meeting at the White House with President Trump. Mr. Netanyahu mentioned he was open to a regional meeting of some sort of a deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace, and Mr. Trump agreed that it would be a good idea. Once again, Michael Fishbach.
Yes, and some commentators have pointed out the seeming contradiction between his statement of interest in the idea of a regional kind of conference or a regional peace process versus the fact that he was unable to commit himself a year ago to that very process. But again, I think we on this side of the Atlantic need to be cognizant, just as in any country, the immense difficulties that the Prime Minister of Israel has in keeping a viable coalition together with so many different kinds of parties. And there are some that are adamantly opposed to any kind of withdrawal from the occupied territories and any kind of peace that would involve regional partners like Jordan and Egypt would surely demand a withdrawal from all, if not or most, if not all, of the West Bank. So that's really what it comes down to, is the ability of the Israeli public, as expressed in their government, to decide whether they're really willing to make those kind of painful compromises.
That is Michael Fishbach. He is a Middle East scholar at Randolph-Macon College. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump spent part of his weekend interviewing people who might be the next national security advisor. Mr. Trump had asked Michael Flynn, a former Army general, to resign that position because he misled Vice President Mike Pence about phone conversations he had with the Russian ambassador to Washington before the new administration took office. President Trump also spent part of his weekend criticizing the news media about its coverage of his presidency, but this time he explicitly called news organizations, and I quote, the enemy of the American people. VOA's Senate correspondent Michael Bowman shares his observations about all of this with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
President Trump took to Twitter after a week of, shall we say, fairly negative press coverage and declared that America's top news outlets, both print and broadcast, are the enemy of the people. This evokes sort of Stalinist language. Enemy of the people is the sort of thing that you assume you hear before you're sent to a Soviet gulag right back in the day. So this raised a lot of eyebrows. On Saturday in Florida, he held a rally. He said that the news media is a big part of America's problem, that the news media is part of a corrupt system, that it lies to the people, and that it is his job to set the news media straight. Those weren't his exact words, but that was the gist of his message. And as you can imagine, in a country where freedom of speech is enshrined in the Constitution, this has raised a lot of eyebrows, Jim.
The last time we heard a president say that the media was the enemy of the people was by Richard Nixon, although his comments were in private, and they were recorded and became public later. President Trump is right out there with it. He doesn't hide this fact at all. And in fact, he has been making such statements for the past year or so as he was even campaigning for the White House.
You know, I think all politicians, whether they're liberal or conservative or somewhere in between, have sort of a love-hate relationship with the news media. They can't control the coverage that they receive, and they are very much aware that people who can vote them in or out of office are bombarded with stories from various outlets whenever they turn on the radio in the car, whenever they turn on their television at home, whenever they pick up a newspaper, whenever they click on a story on the internet. And so there's this tremendous feeling among politicians that when there's a story that does not reflect well on what they've been saying or what they've been doing or what they've been proposing, that that's unfair. And that's simply a very human reaction that I think anyone can identify with. What is new here is taking that anger that all politicians at one time or another are going to feel about the coverage that they receive from the press and to lash out at the press and to label them in such a way that they are seen as somehow un-American or somehow a enemy of the people, when in fact I think for anyone who is sort of a history of America's democracy or democracies in general, a free and open press is considered very much one of the fundamental building blocks of an open society, of a pluralistic democracy, where government has to be held to account. And if you ask any reporter, they feel that responsibility.
That is VOA's Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Well, the Pulitzer Prize-winning group PolitiFact says it feels a responsibility when it comes to what public figures say and whether what they say is correct. Katie Sanders is PolitiFact's deputy editor. International Edition's Lori London asked her if they rated President Trump's comment about the news media being an enemy of the people.
We did not rate that claim. I hope it is obvious that the press is not the enemy of the American people. That's certainly not how we see our mission. We view our work as a public service. You know, our goal and our agenda, so to speak, is to hold politicians accountable for what they say. and to tell voters when they're saying things that are right and when they're saying things that are wrong.
His chief of staff went on the Sunday shows and also reiterated the fact about these so-called fake news stories and the media, and that saying the media doesn't really cover the big stories, doesn't cover terrorism and such as it should. Did you hear any of that?
I did hear what Ryan Priebus said on several shows this morning, because we cover the Sunday shows. And, you know, this is more, frankly, noise coming from the White House that ignores that the media covers major terrorist attacks. They cover medium terrorist attacks. The White House produced a list of 78 attacks that they said were undercovered after Donald Trump said that the media wasn't covering terrorist attacks. And we found instances where the media had, in fact, covered them. We went case by case on PolitiFact.com. So this wasn't exactly a brand new point of view that we've heard from the White House, but that doesn't change the fact that it's not true.
This one's getting a lot of publicity. Was this comment?
We've got to keep our country safe. You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
That's getting a lot of a lot of attention because apparently Sweden didn't know what he was talking about. How do you rate that?
We rate his claim as false on our Truth-O-Meter scale. The claim is inaccurate. We looked and looked for something significant that happened Friday night in Sweden, just as many people in Sweden did. And there was nothing that happened along the lines of scary attack or scary refugee-connected attack or some kind of event that fell in with the other examples, Paris, Nice, Brussels, etc., that he gave during the rally. So when he's saying, look at what's happening last night in Sweden, people were taken aback by that and they were confused. But for us, we say words matter, and we felt comfortable putting that on our Truth-O-Meter scale because there just wasn't anything to it. A lot of what he said during the rally, we have already fact-checked. So one example was him saying that he saved millions and millions of dollars on the military's F-35 contract. He said he negotiated hundreds of millions of dollars off the price with Lockheed Martin. But when we checked that out in the past, we rated it mostly false, which means there's an element of truth, but it's really distorting the facts to leave you with a different impression. The truth is that the savings are a little higher than what they initially projected, but they were already on the decline. So Donald Trump is taking attention and elevating attention to something that was already in the works before he took office. But he left the voters that were at the rally and the people who listened with a very different impression that he and he alone was able to make that happen. And when we did our pretty exhaustive story, we found that was not the case.
And lastly, he was also defending the immigration ban that is currently stalled in the court. Let's listen to what he said to the crowd about immigrants.
We've allowed thousands and thousands of people into our country, and there was no way to vet those people. There was no documentation. There was no nothing.
Trump has said this before. This is a go-to talking point for him, and it's just frankly so misleading and inaccurate. We rate it false. A refugee vetting system does exist and has existed for more than 30 years. You would not necessarily know that from listening to his comments. To be admitted into the country, you have to go through often a United Nations guided process that crosses several federal government agencies. There's background check after background check, and the whole process can take 1 to 2 years. Even though, you know, no system is foolproof, we've talked about this issue with experts again and again, and they always say no system is foolproof, especially when you're dealing with people from conflict zones. But the U.S. isn't just opening its arms, you know, wide for people who don't have any paper trail. That's the portrayal that President Trump is giving, but that's not really the reality at all.
That is Katie Sanders. She is deputy editor of PolitiFact. She was speaking with my colleague Lori London. Well, now it's time to find out what's trending on social media. G. Abby Lee is here with the latest. Hey, G., what's this I hear about a debate on whether chess players are athletes? Is that really going online?
Hi, Steve. Yes, there is. That's because a Russian chess grandmaster described himself as one of Russia's most decorated athletes. Garry Kasparov's comment on BBC's The Andrew Marr Show raised a few eyebrows, and the debate is whether chess players are athletes. A few chess players are joking on Twitter that finally they can claim an athletic physique. A smaller number of people agreed with Kasparov, writing, In competitive sport, you need both brains and brawn, which are required in playing chess.
Yeah, I got you, G. What else out there is trending?
The tumultuous relationship between President Trump and the press took center stage in Sunday's political talk shows. These are two notable remarks that are trending on Twitter from Sunday, made by White House Chief of Staff Ryan Priebus. Priebus asked the American people to take the president seriously when he calls press, quote-unquote, the enemy. He also said one should be concerned about mainstream news outlets acting like Washington daily gossip magazines. Some people tweeted the news outlets should just report the news truthfully because they have oversight and a responsibility to the public, but others said if the media doesn't like the label the enemy, it should do a better job.
Busy day on social media. Hey, got anything else?
In New York, thousands rallied around the slogan, "I am a Muslim too," to show solidarity with the Muslim community in the midst of the travel ban. Hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons and Women's March organizer Linda Sarsour led the event. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo also showed support for the rally by using the hashtag, #IAmAMuslimToo. Steve?
Many thanks there, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Always good to have you here, G. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In January 2016, two astronomers at the California Institute of Technology provided evidence of a giant planet traveling in an odd, drawn-out orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. The evidence for its existence is based on the gravitational influence the planet seems to have on several minor planet-sized objects beyond the orbit of the solar system's furthest planet, Neptune. Astronomers around the world have been actively scanning the skies since the discovery was announced, hoping to spot the humongous planet. NASA is now seeking the help of citizen scientists to locate Planet 9 with the launch of its new website, Backyard World's Planet 9. The website features brief movies made from images captured by NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE, mission. The address for the new NASA website is backyardworlds.org. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, there's a new movie out there starring Charlie Hunnam and Robert Pattinson. It's telling the story of a British adventurer who vanished while searching for a lost city in the Amazon jungle. VOA's David Byrd tells us that The Lost City of Zed recounts British explorer Percy Fawcett's attempt to find that ancient city until his own disappearance in 1925.
You dream to be in a forest.
I wish to find a lost city.
What you seek is far greater than you ever imagined. Your soul will never be quiet until you find this place. It is your destiny.
Percy Fawcett was a real-life Indiana Jones, a member of the Royal Artillery, a spy, and a trained explorer for the British Royal Geographic Society. He was a man with a sense of his own destiny. Fawcett led several expeditions into the Amazon jungle, searching for a lost city he referred to as Zed. Then, in 1925, Fawcett and his son Raleigh vanish and are never heard from again. Fawcett's quest for the mythical city is the plot for The Lost City of Zed, a new movie from Brad Pitt's Plan B production company and Paramount Pictures. Charlie Hunnam plays Fawcett. He says the more he got to know the real adventurer, the more respect he had for him.
The more that I researched and the more I got into learning about the complexities and nuances of him as a man and his life, I got to really like him and admire him from what I could tell, and I felt even greater sense of responsibility to try to get him right and or at least as close to our perception of who he was as possible.
Robert Pattinson plays Fawcett's aide-de-camp Henry Costin. Pattinson says he had to walk a fine line as a modern actor playing a man who lived in a time of British colonialism.
the colonialism of that time just was so different in how those characters felt it. I mean, it really felt like at the very beginning of something, so it's kind of, you know, no one could have predicted what would happen afterwards. These are just guys who just kind of just went with no particular plan. They just wanted to explore and to see what was there, like what was in their eyes the unknown.
Director James Gray worked for 6 years developing the movie. He said at the London premiere that he felt it was a story that had to be told.
It's very difficult to find a story as good as this, which falls right into your lap, about a person of such incredible ambition and such transcendent beauty, you know, going into the jungle and fighting in the war, an amazing life.
Sienna Miller plays Fawcett's long-suffering wife, Nina. She said at the London premiere that working with Gray was what drew her to the project, but then she fell in love with her character.
James Gray was the initial draw. I've loved his films, and he works with amazing actors and always gets great performances. He's always character-driven. And then the script was this adventurous film, and this woman was so brave and resilient and strong and a suffragette and a mother, and I just loved everything about it.
The film crew had to endure many of the hardships that Fawcett himself faced, including monsoon rains, insects and disease while filming in the jungles of Colombia. The Lost City of Zed was shown at the New York Film Festival and is set for wide release in the United States in April. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave. I can't wait to see it. Lost City of Zed will be there. Well, SpaceX has successfully launched its unmanned Falcon 9 cargo rocket from the Kennedy Space Center, U.S. state of Florida. It's going to take food, all kinds of stuff, up to the International Space Station. It's the 10th of 20 cargo missions contracted out to the private firm SpaceX by the U.S. space agency NASA. Congratulations to them. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.